Hello, cyclocross friends, and welcome to episode 91 of Crosshairs Radio. On today's show, we have the two founders of the Garneau Easton, presented by Transitions Life Care Team. That would be Michael Vandenham and also Dylan Postier. It was great to talk to both of these guys. We did sort of this late night dispatch from Baltimore right near Druid Hill Park on a porch, like it should be done in Baltimore. We talked pretty much about everything. I think if you are a cyclocross nerd and geek and fan and all of the above, you're going to dig it. Good conversation. Love chatting with these guys. This episode, as all of our episodes have been, is brought to you by Health IQ. And you should go to healthiq.com/CXHairs. You're going to get savings on life insurance if you qualify. And to qualify, you have to do what you're already doing, which is riding your bike like 50 miles a week, living a healthy lifestyle. These are the type of things that Health IQ values. It's the type of thing that the way that they value it differs from other life insurance companies that, for whatever reason, don't seem to understand fitness and look at BMI and look at things that don't give a good picture of the people that they are investing in by selling life insurance policies. Health IQ does that, and you can get lower rates from them if you qualify, as I said. But to do that, you need to go to healthiq.com/CXHairs, fill out a survey, take a test. It's an exam. It's about cycling. It's actually really fun. I did pretty well. I was surprised. And you will too. I won't be surprised about that. But yeah, they are a huge supporter of this podcast and also the Wide Angle Podium Podcast Network. We want them to continue to be, and to do that, I need to get you all engaged and go over to healthiq.com/CXHairs and participate. So do that. While you're on the internet, you can also go to wideanglepodium.com and become a member. Support all the shows that we're putting out. Bike Shop CX, Honest Bicycle Program, We Got to Hang Out, Consummate Athlete, Slow Ride Podcast, The Meyerson Line has new episodes up there, Dirt Field Recordings has new episodes up there, Kids Don't Follow has new episodes up there. It's a ton of content, 1 million downloads. If we got $1 per download, I wouldn't be talking to you right now, but we don't. And it's up to you to change that. We need your support. Wideanglepodium.com. All right, let's talk to Mike and Dylan, and let's do that right now.
Yeah, it's amazing how many kids are really bad at answering emails. So that's like step number one.
Just emails?
Yeah, just emails. Just
everything.
Like, this is how you fill out a spreadsheet. This is how you answer an email.
So to answer your question, yes, I have started recording.
Good. We're already bemoaning the kids.
Yeah, this week was a perfect example of it. Like, we send out travel plans a month in advance and say, fill out this form when you're arriving, when you're racing, do you need host housing? So I got an email on Tuesday from one of our Devo kids asking if they had host housing.
Oh,
and yeah. So we were already to the max.
Like, so, did you fill out the email? What form in the email? You're like, no, the one we sent out last month.
Yeah, they reply back, yeah, I did now. So
I guess to come around, hopefully through this process, they'll learn that they do need to like stay on top of their travel plans for next time, and they'll become more fully functioning adults as a result.
Well, that's part of development. So that's what you guys are doing. All right, we need to actually let people know who's who here. So quickly introduce yourselves.
Okay, I'm Michael Vandenham. I guess we both race. Before this, I managed a team called Garneau Easton, which it's confusing because it still sounds like we're on Garneau Easton, but it was actually a separate entity last year. So myself and Craig Ritchie, who's the marketing manager for Easton, ran like a four-rider Garneau Easton team that was primarily based out of Canada, while Dylan, who I'll let introduce himself in a second, ran the renewed CX team. And it ended up with the sponsors that we took on that were still the Garneau Easton team. We brought on a presenting sponsor, Transitions Life Care. but we are actually two teams. We were two separate entities last year, and we came together as one team. Dylan can tell you a little bit more about.
So what is the official name?
It's Garno Easton, presented by Transitions Healthcare, or TLC, if it gets a little bit much. But we also have a Devo program where the sponsors are actually switched. So Transitions Life Care is the title sponsor for the Devo team, and it's presented by Garno Easton.
Mm-hmm. Are the kits any different?
So the kits are actually almost exact inverses of each other.
Okay.
So if you see the blue kits are all the pro team.
Oh, okay.
And then the neon kits are all the Devo team.
All right.
But it's kind of cool. We wanted some continuity between the two teams. We wanted people to look at them and go, oh, yeah, that's the same thing, but not quite.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually stole the idea from Cannondale.
To be shameless about it.
Is I saw that last year.
Yeah,
because last year was the first year where they switched. They used to have like the green team
and the red team.
Right?
Now it's just it's subtle, on like the cuffs.
And we really want to focus that like this is all still the same program,
mm-hmm.
right? And wanted to highlight that. And I think that was actually a change for the Cannondale team too. When it was a red team, it was like a different program.
Right.
They lived under a different tent. And all this, and now it's the same program, and they like share the same resources.
So, what was it you were going to say that you were going to let Dylan talk about?
I was going to let Dylan introduce himself, but I'll just steal the show here. It's okay.
Yeah. So I'm Dylan Postier. I started Renewed Cyclocross last year, which was just a smaller elite level team. I had one other rider, Tyler Cloutier, and then ended up hiring another U23 woman, Peyton Manis, at the end of the year. And so we both coached for Cycle Smart. He came and stayed with me for a couple months or a couple weeks,
months?
A couple weeks over Ruts and Guts last year. And, we just kind of started talking. We started looking at our resources, you know, the industry sponsors he had and some of the non-industry, partners I had, and started looking at some of our strengths and weaknesses of Craig and Michael and myself. And like, you know, we could really make something work here. That could be sustained.
Where are you out of?
I'm out of Oklahoma.
Okay.
And that was like one of the next steps I felt for our little Canadian team that was really problematic is there was no way for us really to have any resources at the races because Craig is based out of Vancouver. I'm based out of Vancouver area now. Like it's completely impractical to have a trailer and a setup that's based out of there. And while you don't need that stuff, there's definitely something to be said for having a home at the races. And now I'm not flying with bikes anymore, which is a huge, it doesn't sound like a lot. So I don't expect to get any sympathy saying, last year I had to pack my bikes every now and then, but it definitely adds up. Taking a day to pack everything to go to a race as opposed to throwing your clothes in a bag and hopping on the plane.
But you were doing that most North Americans, maybe it is different for Canadians, don't do that every race. You know?
No, I was doing that every race.
Yeah, that's the difference.
Right, because I think this is the same thing for, it's getting better on the West Coast, but this is the same thing for anyone on the West Coast. Like, we don't have the big, strong Midwest series or the New England series of local UCI races, and even some, you know, people in the Midwest, even some, like, World Cups and...
Yeah.
And for people in New England and whatever you call this region, New England South.
Oh. Mid-Atlantic.
The Mid-Atlantic.
But here's the thing. Even with that, like people like Pennsylvania and New Jersey all want to claim Mid-Atlantic too.
Right.
So I like
keep them out.
I like to say we're Southern Mid-Atlantic.
Southern Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah.
So not in New England at all.
No, like Maryland, D.C., you know, Delaware. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's if you ask USA Cycling, that is the Mid-Atlantic. We are right now in MABRA, which is the Mid-Atlantic Bike Racing Association's region. So that's.
I guess all that to say is, once upon a time, the closest UCI race to me was Bend, but that one disappeared.
Right.
And that's when I lived in Edmonton, so it was still like a 20, I think it was 20 hours of driving to get to Bend.
Jeez.
And like that was the one we drove to because it was close.
That's I mean, you probably do that. You probably were driving a lot to races as well, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's getting a lot better. Like he said, when I first started racing UCI stuff back in 2013 or so, my closest one was St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
which was 7 hours. I think Boulder was 9 hours. And then everything else was a 2-day drive.
Right.
So we had nothing. And now you look at the caliber of Ruts and Guts. You have the one-day Hurtland race. You have Resolution. We've had Waco down in Texas. All those are within 1 hour to 4 hours.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, there's a bunch of that second. Like, there's still Boulder. There's still Indy is the new one.
Yeah, Boulder and Indy are all within a day's drive. So that's kind of what we looked at our schedule and set up, like, what C1s can we get to, and then what other big races can we easily get the trailer to without overtaxing.
Yeah, and we made a conscious decision not to do the U.S. Cup this year, just because partly because we have a lot of Canadian riders, and it overlaps with Canadian Nationals, which is just like that's nothing against Canadian Nationals, nothing against the U.S. Cup. I think the U.S. Cup, as awesome as it is, it came together fairly late in the game, so I would expect by next year a lot of these like scheduling problems aren't going to exist anymore, and then we'll turn our team to maybe focusing on hopefully it's still around, but focusing on the U.S. Cup, because as a team that is a little bit removed, even in Oklahoma, from a lot of racing, I think it's important to have, everyone said this, but important to have that continuity and have some sort of narrative throughout the year. You know, you do the World Cups and you focus on this series, and then we go to what, you know, we go to what we can locally.
So, do you think it was just the naming it, calling it the U.S. Cup that did this? Because you have, like, the Victoria Series. Or is it because that they look at that as a New England series, where it's actually a national series as well? I just don't want to get either of you in trouble here, but every time
someone hypes the U.S. Cup, I feel like Adam Meyerson is cringing a little bit, being like, yeah, but the Victoria Series has been here forever, for years, right?
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference, right? Like, it's branded as the New England series. It's, I don't have an incentive for myself to go up there apart from to support Cycle Smart, to whereas this, for example, like,
but, I mean, honestly, it'd be awesome if either of you did, but both of you probably aren't going home with $10,000 when this thing is done.
No, definitely not. Yeah. It's already, with my race today, and missing two rounds at Nationals, like, that's so far out of the question. And, and I didn't go to KMC because I knew that missing a single...
Okay, the power just went out. No, the power did not go out. The batteries died in my recorder.
Don't give Baltimore a bad name. It already has better name as it does.
We are sitting outside on the porch in a nice row house in Baltimore. This is a nice neighborhood. Mm-hmm. What, like 3 miles?
So. What's the crime show about Baltimore called?
The Wire.
The Wire.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen much Wire lately, and I'm feeling pretty safe here. I don't know. Like, the Wire hypes it up like this is this terrible place, but it's really nice.
Well,
it's all, like, old brick houses.
I love Baltimore. Mm-hmm. I love Jewett Hill Park. It does feature in The Wire.
Yeah, I was riding around in Jewett Hill Park at night with my lights on, and I was like, huh. I feel like if this were a horror movie or if this were a cop show, this is where I'd get murdered and buried in the forest.
Yeah,
and, for sure, 100%.
And if you walk around, you know, if you sort of drive around there, like the whole thing with the boarded up, just blocks and blocks of boarded up row houses, that still exists, but it's, you know, it's slowly changing.
Yeah, I mean, that neighborhood we were in with all the cafes and stuff is pretty gentrified. Like, it's a hip. It's a hip-hopping place.
And that's it. And one thing that still is true for now, although it's starting to change, it's so much less expensive to live here than D.C.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think a lot of that arts community and everything
finds
a good home in Baltimore. So
yeah, I keep on thinking that Detroit's going to be the next major arts center.
I think you're right. I know people that live around there who think it's an amazing city. Mm-hmm. But they definitely cities are tough, and DC is tough. The DC is like a definite have and have not. You know, there's not a lot.
Mm-hmm. You
know, we're kind of in the middle, but we're few and far between.
I've never been to DC, and I'm not even going to your race this year.
Well, you know,
I know.
See, you are starting to fall. So you gotta keep. There you go. This is microphone thing training. I don't even know what we were talking about before we got cut off.
U.S. Cup, maybe?
Yeah, oh, that's right. Yeah, no, we were talking about, and just geographic sort of breakdown of races and all that kind of.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, we were talking about the Vittoria series.
Yeah. And possibly just how it's just branding.
I think it's partly branding. I think it's partly the U.S. Cup jumped in and brought together a bunch of C1s, which, yep. to be honest, like, those top guys were going to go to them anyways.
Yeah.
So it just provided, it's like, it provided a storyboard to spring. Well,
it's also, it's shorter, mm-hmm. so you're not doing all eight C1s, mm-hmm. which is, and I think with people's attention span now. I do believe, though, that it needs to be, if you're going to have a national series, you have to, and they know this, I'm not saying anything that the people don't know, it has to be national, and it certainly is an East Coast, Midwest.
It would be amazing series. if I don't know, Bend or wherever nationals are in 2020, if they were able to hold a round of the U.S. Cup in Tacoma or...
But there still aren't any... West Coast C1s, right?
No, they're all... There's CXLA, and now there's Sacramento.
Oh, CXLA is a C1?
No, sorry. I mean, like, just for UCI races.
No, but they're all C2s. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There are no C1s.
And, like, those are great races. West Sacramento looked like it was really good this year.
Really good, yeah.
It's unfortunate they were overlapped with the first round of the U.S. Cup.
Right.
But...
And ruts could be good for that, too, in the future. You know, it's about as far west as you can get. And
they're a C1,
the
right?
Event, it's right. top notch.
Can you imagine if there's going to be four rounds? Wouldn't it be cool if there was a West Coast round, a New England round, a Mid-Atlantic round, and like a, you know, a ruts, like somewhere in the south?
Sort of, yeah,
that'd like be really cool.
Southwest-ish. I mean,
that's the easier said than done. I'll just...
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're talking about flying places, and then everybody's... Yeah. On planes.
Yeah, and I know Ryan put these races together thinking that, oh, you can drive to them and they're mostly back to back. So if someone wanted to be on the road for that whole time,
right.
or if they were somewhere central, probably this area wouldn't be a bad place to be. You could
kind of what your leader is doing. I mean, Tobin is basically, I doubt he's been home.
No, he hasn't. I talked to him. He said he's not going home until... I want to say Gloucester, and then he's going home and then coming back for those next two rounds.
Yeah, and doing it out of a rental truck. I mean, no trailer, no nothing.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I'm not sure where he's... I know one of his big sponsors is Donkey Label, and I know he hung out with them in... Was it Minneapolis, Chicago?
They are Chicago.
Chicago?
Yeah. And that was the funny thing. So for Jingle Cross, he had a great setup.
Yeah.
Because they brought everything.
Yeah,
but I mean, other than that, I mean, when he was in Rochester, he was out of the back of a car.
Yeah, yeah, and well, he was out of the back of the car all year last year, and I think him and Chris McGovern, his mechanic, just have like, they just have their setup dialed and they know what they're doing. And Chris is like seems like a very organized top level wrench who, like, they break something, he is the spare part. They've got it figured out. If you're going to be a racer from the West Coast and not drive a trailer across the whole country, I think Tobin's doing a pretty good job of that.
Yeah. What do you guys do for a mechanic?
This year we've been contracting people at races. Yeah.
Okay.
The next step for the team is to get like a full-time mechanic. It's just nice to have someone you're familiar with, but that's a big... We're still a small budget team relative to a lot of things out there, and we're, you know, obviously we're one of only two UCI teams, but... I think if you were to compare Powers' overall budget with our overall budget, there's not really... They aren't that close to each other, let's
just say. We think our money goes a long ways with what we have, probably relative to a lot of teams out there. I mean, we have some great partners, but...
And that's one of the reasons that we are a rider-owned and rider-operated team, is that we're operating really lean, and having the riders manage everything allows us to do that. You know, we don't, besides contracting mechanics at races, we don't have any overhead that's not going towards the riders.
Yeah.
Right. We're taking care of our trailer and stuff like that. And then everything else that we get is going back into supporting our riders. So whether that's the pro team or we have the development team, you know, right now, I think that we're doing the best job we possibly can at giving, when sponsors support us, I think we're doing a good job at giving all that support back to the people that ride for our team.
What is, I don't know if we ever really even said what the whole roster is.
Yeah. So we have a 6-rider pro team.
Yeah.
So that's myself, Dylan Post here, Craig Ritchie, Gunnar Holmgren, and then we have Natasha Elliott, who's riding like a bit of a reduced schedule this year, but she's on that team. And then Erica Zaveda. So a lot of people probably remember Erica Zaveda from a few years ago, but she was the original Amy D recipient.
Right, right.
And then I think she rode for Max's Shimano for a year, and then basically last year and maybe even the year before that took a step away from cyclocross. But I think when we were just really impressed with her through emails and talking to her on the phone, and Sierra has like a huge amounts of potential. Once she gets a couple UCI points again, like, she had some great seasons or great results with Amy mm-hmm. D and great results with Max's Shimano.
Yeah, and she's still, I mean, she's riding well and still has the potential, right, with riding for Cannondale or Silence on the road. You know, they obviously see something in her too, and we see the same. And, you know, she was up there contesting for wins at one point. So, I mean, it kind of goes along with what Mike was saying. Like, we don't have a $500,000 budget to throw around. So some of the riders that we choose are people that we believe in, that we see potential in, that other people may be overlooking at that current moment. I know Erica didn't have another ride going into this year, and she was somebody that we firmly believe in. And that kind of goes along with what we're doing with the Devo team as well. Although,
how many riders on that?
So we have seven. Wow. We have five Canadians and two Americans on the Devo team.
Yeah.
And so most of them do have national championships already or podiums at Nats and have been there. But as we were saying earlier, there's still a lot of skills that we believe that we can help them out with. And I think Cross Vegas is probably a pretty good indication of that, going to the sponsored booths. And, you know, mm-hmm. you take some things for granted depending on how you're raised and maybe your circumstances. But, you know, teaching people to say thank you, you know, to say please, to give people shout outs on social media naturally, to be grateful for those things. Like, what do you do when you see a sponsor at a race? You know, you lose a pair of gloves. Like, how do you approach that with the sponsor to get more if we don't have it laying around the trailer? So all those different things will hopefully help them not only in cycling, but in the rest of their life as well.
And yeah, that's, I mean, that's running, really our goal. Managing yourself as a cyclist at a fairly high level, you know, high level amateur or professional cyclist, you're really managing a little business in a way, you know, especially if you're doing an individual program or doing a team program like we are, where, you know, you have to go and make proposals and approach people and manage, you know, social media relations, customer service.
And I see that with a lot mm-hmm. of athletes. Kerry Werner, for instance, comes to mind, and he's somebody who's like always on top. He's like, well, why isn't, you know, he always wants to know, like, at races, why isn't this happening? Why, you know, it's very mm-hmm. sort of hands on. It's not like, and I think that's a lot with, cyclocross is, since that money isn't there. It's not a huge road team where everybody's just on the bus, off the bus, on their bikes.
Yeah, when you look at the athletes that have been successful in cyclocross, it's often not the people that were just talented, it's the people that were able to bring like a more complete package with a little bit of interpersonal skills and a little bit of business skills and, you know, of course a good deal of physical talent, but it's all the other things that matter too. Yeah. Like, we were talking about Powers a little bit earlier, and one of the things that makes him like so successful is obviously he's this great cyclist, but he is the whole Aspire Racing, and before that Rafa Focus. Like, he created a brand for himself.
Yep.
And that's what made him successful.
Yeah. Did you feel more comfortable partnering with Dylan because he has a Canadian sounding last name?
Yeah, well, I thought it was Postier, but apparently it's Postier. You just gotta get a little lazier there. Not Postier, Postier.
I mean, he could have been like, you know, on a fourth line of an NHL team, you know.
It's true. Fourth line, huh?
Fourth line. I'm giving him the goon. Yeah. I mean, it's cyclocross. It's the goon line. You know?
He was a college quarterback for football. So he definitely has a lot more athletic, like, hand-eye coordination than I'll ever have. If someone were to throw me something, I think it would just hit me in the head.
How is that transition? That's pretty awesome. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up kind of the typical jock, right? Playing football, basketball, baseball, running track from the moment I was 4 years old. You know, could have had, I guess, had the option to go play college at about anything, and committed to go play football, and then actually decided I wanted to race my motorcycle instead, motocross.
Wow, that's awesome. Okay.
Yeah, I'd been racing since I was 8, mixing that in with all the sports too. And then before that, racing other IndyCar, go-kart type development series. And so just decided that's what I wanted to pursue, even though I kind of knew I wasn't going to make a living for myself. But eventually stalled out, had too many injuries, and it was like, oh, hey, here's a bike. Let me ride that and see what happens.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of parallels between motocross and cyclocross in the business side. Like, there's the really successful people who make a lot of money, the Matthew Vanderpools, the Wout Van Aerts, and then there's a lot of other people who are doing what we're doing and doing, you know, who are hustling to make things work.
Skill-wise, I'm assuming, because I've talked to some guys who've sort of been that before, but it seems like cornering, being able to accelerate in and out of turns, all those things seem to translate really well. Like, you already have those skills, even though you're producing the power now on your own.
You know, everything's in slow motion. Like, we're always talking about how do we replicate race scenarios in training without having to go that deep all the time. So, you know, we're out here hitting corners at, say, 10 miles an hour, 15 miles an hour. Maybe you hit a fast turn at 20 miles an hour. Well, when you're on a motorcycle, you're always hitting things at 20, 30, 40 miles an hour. So everything's coming in a flash. So you get out here on a bike and things are just in slow motion.
That's interesting.
Like, setting up your turns is so much slower. Like, it's like, okay, I need to go out to the tape and then I'm going to cut down. And so you see the races. I think you're more composed and, you know, waiting the outside of the bike, you know, looking up through the turn, the balance, the lean, like, all those principles still apply. And I think it's probably evident with my riding. That's what comes easy to me. You know, it's always a struggle to develop that power. And that's basically what my whole career is focused on, is trying to grab the power to go with the handling.
When you can definitely, like, I can definitely see that if it's a little bit loose in the corners or if there's a rut or something like that, you're just good at it. Partly because you're working at it as a cross racer too, but like that with all those years of finding the limits of your tires in motocross, like, that comes pretty easily to you.
Yeah, and I mean, I think a big part of it, and something that a lot of people struggle to break through at the amateur level that I see, is they can't turn off that switch, right? You see people that are hesitant, and it may not always be apparent to the fans, but if you ride behind somebody, they're just feathering that brake a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to turn off that switch and realize that most of the time in cycling, the consequences really aren't that great. There's very few wrecks where you actually hurt yourself in cycling.
Right.
In cyclocross, especially.
In America. I know overseas there's different courses that challenge you a little more than most of ours do, but for the most part, we don't have anything that's dangerous like in motocross, to where, you know, when I was training riding just a couple times a week, I mean, you hit the ground at good speed once a week, every 2 weeks, and those are injuries to where you may not break anything, but you're down for a week and a half. You're super sore. So, but I have found from getting away from motocross that I lose that a little bit. So when I go back to riding a motorcycle, like this last spring, of course, injuries came with that. But I found that I'm a lot more timid on the motorcycle
now. Interesting,
But then when I hop back on the bicycle and go mountain biking for training or riding cross, it's like, wow, this is really boring at the moment. We're going so slow.
Yeah. I think you see that a lot with the even cross-country mountain bikers, like tons of them also, you know, ride motorcycles off-road stuff, you know, and that's, I think, a big part of.
And well, Matthew was riding a dirt bike for a while this spring. I think probably just because he does whatever he wants, but wasn't he ripping around?
I think that's probably right. Yeah.
Yeah. He just has, like, I just imagine going to Matthew's house and they'd be like, I think he probably lives with his dad still, Audrey. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. He had like these pictures of this beautiful looking like outdoor porch thing, and I don't know if that was just somewhere they were.
But
staying.
I just imagine having
there were
fun
dogs garage. Running around, so I figure that's yeah.
Well, David has the dogs, right?
Yeah.
Aren't the Dalmatians David's?
I don't know. You're more into this than I am.
I don't know. No. It's because I'm pretty sure my wife follows David Vanderpool on Instagram because of the Dalmatians.
That makes sense.
That's the only reason. She's like, oh, whatever. But the Dalmatians are cute.
I can see that.
We were joking that it's like, well, we were talking about how we have Erica Zaveda on our team because she's a good rider, but she also is a cute puppy. So we didn't know that before, but that's like an important added perk.
That's important.
The cute puppy is good. But yeah, I imagine like in Matthews, he must just have a shed that he rolls out the doors like, oh, there's my Beamer. There's my dirt bike.
Right,
here's
exactly.
These are all my toys. This is my quad.
Yeah. Must be nice.
He lives like some sort of cyclocross version of Nitro Circus, doing less stupid things. Yeah.
That would be a show. The Belgian Nitro Circus.
Did you did you ever watch that show? It was last year. It followed around Wout and Matthew, Lauren Sweek, and Ellie Iserbit. It was called... it was all in Flemish, so it was really difficult to understand. It was something about, I forget what the name translated to. The Next Kings or something Kings.
I did, only because for Jingle Cross, I had to... I got the opportunity to interview Iserbit, and we did, this phone interview, and then I asked him my kind of... standard what do you eat for breakfast and the whole thing, and he was like, oh, that's funny to ask because that was a big thing in Belgium because of that show,
right?
Because they showed him and he was like
eating waffles or something, and they're like, oh, no, you cannot do that.
No, it was like chicken, rice, and applemousse, which is basically applesauce.
Yeah, they don't. That sounds right to me. They really like basic starches and meat, and aren't really that into vegetables in Belgium.
Yeah, although I went to Ghent during the classics.
Yeah,
about 3 or 4 years ago, which was awesome, and Ghent the biggest vegetarian and vegan restaurants in Europe, possibly.
Yeah,
it's
so when
I've huge community there.
I've always stayed at the Chainstay in Oudenaarde, which is 30 minutes, not even. Yeah, maybe 30 minutes south of Ghent, and we would go there, and the food scene is really good there. But I think when you go out even to Oudenaarde or all the other smaller towns, it's definitely different. Ghent very much feels like an artsy city anywhere in the world. They have they have third wave coffee shops, and they have little bakeries, and they have they have 4 euro pastries and things like
that.
That
was kind of my experience in the Czech Republic, because it's you're in Novo Mesto where it's not, you're not getting that same experience. going into the grocery store and there is nothing green here. Nothing, zero.
But I shouldn't complain about Belgium. I actually really, I've enjoyed all my time in Belgium so far. I think the people are, they seem to get a bad rap. I think Belgium in general seems to get a bad rap among Americans, but the people are really nice. I've always felt super welcomed.
Yeah.
It's one of those places where I don't think anyone in Belgium... it's not the type of culture that they're going to go out of their way to say hi to you, but if you need something, they're going to help you.
Yeah. I think that's, yes. But I mean, we see that in the U.S. too, at places where people aren't going to, because they
want
to mind
like
their
Boston,
own business,
right?
But then at the same time, I will say that, so in that same trip, we did the Flanders Sportif, and then we did the, Paris-Roubaix Sportif.
Yeah.
The Belgian one was so much better run, and everyone was so much nicer, and the French one was just a disaster.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been... I've traveled to France a few times, but I've gone to, the more off-the-beaten-track places for the great and wonderful Ligny-Roubaix World Cup.
Yeah.
It's a special thing. And then Nome, which I guess is back in the World Cup circuit
this
year.
It is, right,
But France, it's very much, when you're not in Paris or not in those bigger cities, you can't order something in English. That's not an option.
Right.
You can't, it's just different. Whereas Belgian, I was saying that people don't go out of their way to say hi, but they do go out of their way to make you feel comfortable. Obviously, I've gone and I speak hardly a word of Dutch.
I just start whenever, especially with when you're buying groceries or something, I always start out by just saying hi. And then they switch automatically.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoop, I'm going to speak English to you.
I guess in Canadian fashion, I usually follow that up with a sorry. Like, hi, sorry. My bad, eh?
Have you been to Europe at all, to race? Or are you,
I haven't,
any,
actually.
Any plans to?
Yeah, so we're talking about it this year. You know, with the team stuff, it changes a little bit. Love to go over there and spend a few weeks post-Nats. I do have a wife and a kid back home that... And they're super lenient already with,
sure.
You know, we were on the road for a couple of weeks for Trek and across Vegas and Jingle and all those, and then being gone here and just about every weekend. So, yeah, I definitely like to. That riding suits me. Anytime we get to technical or rutted, you know, my eyes light up like a little kid. So, like a little kid in a candy store.
You and Van Aert just waiting for the heavier courses.
Yeah.
That must be what it is.
How was it doing the Jingle to Vegas to Madison stint?
It wasn't bad. I don't think
because you
bad
all
at
are
all.
I think you could probably count on one hand the at least teams, if not
Absolutely.
Individuals,
so it was
who did all
who
three.
The people who raced the World Cup and then Vegas and then the other World Cup were myself and the Sweeks.
Yeah, okay.
And then on the women's side, I guess there was Ellen and Katarina Nash, and maybe that's it.
Yeah.
And then there were a few people like Dylan who didn't race the World Cup, but raced on both weekends and raced Vegas
right,
in the middle.
Right, still making to those locations.
But it was super funny because we were on the same plane as Lawrence and Dieter, and I guess his whole family, his mom and his dad were there too.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious because they didn't realize last year when they came over that they could fly in and out of Madison. And they didn't realize
really?
They could fly in and out of Cedar
Chicago?
Rapids. So for both trips, they flew to Chicago and drove to Cedar Rapids.
Yeah.
And then flew to Chicago, drove to Madison. And it's like, but like, don't you have Google Flights? I don't understand.
Yeah. Like, so, I mean, it was difficult. You know, you drive to Jingle and you race, and we get out of there late Sunday night. And so we flew out of Cedar Rapids Tuesday, didn't get into Vegas until 11 p.m. their time, which is 1 o'clock central, what we're used
right.
to.
Yeah.
And
right.
then have to wake up the next morning and ride and race. And you're out until, I think we finally got to bed around 4 o'clock central time in Vegas Wednesday night.
Yeah.
Just by the time we wound down and went and got something to eat, and that wasn't even including any extracurricular activities at all. So then you wake up, and we flew into Cedar Rapids Thursday night, I think at 9 p.m., and then have to race in Wisconsin the next day, which is a four-hour drive.
Right, right. I guess I didn't race the next day. I feel like all that travel affected my race in Vegas, but it didn't really affect my – because the World Cup wasn't all the way until Sunday, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
You know, in this case, better. But I don't think it affected my performance at the World Cups. But it definitely, like, I went back and looked at my heart rate data from Vegas, and it was a solid 10 beats below where it should be for a cross race. And I'm chalking that up to fatigue and not being on normal hours and being in the desert in the middle of the night.
What was the scene like there? I mean, for the, you know, you'd been there for the World Cup, so.
It was actually really good.
Yeah.
I think it was still the party at Interbike.
Right.
Even though Interbike's shrinking, like, that's still what people go and do on the Wednesday night.
And they don't, you know, that's the thing. That crowd, I don't think, really cared if it was a World Cup or what
no,
it was.
They just wanted
they
to go and drink and
really
watch a bike
what,
race.
Yeah, cyclocross was.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the crowd there was on par or better than the other two weekends.
Yeah.
From what I saw. I mean,
certainly in terms of rowdiness and loudness.
Yeah, it was a very good atmosphere. And you talked about that before. I think part of that was the World Cups being on Sundays. I mean, you can look at a local race. You have a race on Sunday and no fans show up.
Right.
You do it Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening, and you've got everyone and their grandma coming out to see what people are riding around spandex for. So,
well, if the way that we market this sport to non-cyclists is like, it's NASCAR, you can go in the afternoon, you can drink.
Right.
That doesn't work on Sundays.
Right.
People won't do that.
What did you all think of Friday night at Iowa? I thought that was kind of the highlight as far as crowd and just like energy went.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I
agree. I know why they put it on Sunday, because there was the Hawkeyes game on Saturday.
Right.
And, like, I, of course, I want this World Cup to stay in Iowa or I want these World Cups in America, and I get that you have to cater around these bigger sporting events. But I hate to say, but I think we saw this coming with the crowds that were there last year on Sunday. Like, there was no one there.
No, I know. It was pretty dead.
And the Saturday crowd was pretty good last year, and the Friday crowd is, like I said, it's that party scene. They got the whole weekend ahead of them. I think
that was the one race of those two weekends that I think may have even been bigger than it was last year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that Friday night. Yeah.
I think other disciplines or other sports understand that, right? When you look at games, there's hardly any Sunday afternoon games apart from football, which they basically own the game, and the occasional baseball game. But you look at, you know, not to talk about motocross too much, but their indoor series, which are crowd friendly, you know, they'll run races on Friday night and Saturday night each weekend. And then people travel home on Sunday.
Yeah.
And so you can even tell that the crowds are dying down by Saturday. So many people have energy when it comes to Friday night.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an economic reason to do it, and all these events want those 3 days of racing because you want to get as many amateur races.
Yeah, I wonder what it was like.
That's kind of the...
You were at KMC. What was the Friday night
I wasn't,
there?
No.
You weren't at KMC.
No, I we had it was my first staying at home to be at my own series.
Awesome. Yeah. You need that's. I mean, I didn't race KMC for a few reasons,
which
but
I
one
always
of them
forget,
was just to go home.
Yeah, well, I always... This is so Charm City's in the series that I'm the director for now as well.
Oh.
So it's so all the amateur races are getting points for our Bike Reg Super Series. That's
Yes. Cool. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough with, I think it's on the KMC, you know, it is tough with it following up those World Cups.
Yeah,
these are our hosts showing up.
Hey,
you're now on a podcast. Congratulations.
Oh, wow.
I'm out of your house.
How's it going?
As well.
Yeah, there we go. It knows who you are.
How are you doing?
Full hour.
Cool. Yeah. Oh, you got the one that's spelled right. I have that shirt, and it's my favorite shirt, the one, the Cycolo cross. Yeah, it's nice. Brilliant.
Is it like three shirt. S's or something?
It's Cycolo. There's a O.
It's the Y somehow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, I think it's just like there's an extra O. It's like C-Y-C-O-L-O-C-R-O-S.
Someone came up with a shirt immediately after the Friday night race at Iowa. They're like, oh, we should spell this out like this. This will be great.
Cool, guys.
All right.
Today.
Hey, thanks.
Been here if you want to come inside.
Thank you.
All
right. Yeah. I don't know if everyone knows this, but for a lot of teams, like, host housing is the backbone. It's what makes our budget, you know, our budget work.
A lot of times for media, too.
Yeah, for media.
So Bruce and I did both World Cups and then had an event in Chicago as well, and I think, you know, stayed in one hotel the whole time, which made it, and we drove out there, so you know, it made it so we were still coming back.
I mean, it's huge when you factor in the nights. I mean, just being gone those 2 weeks, we spent two nights in a hotel in Vegas, essentially.
Yeah.
So if you factor in 10, 12 days at $100 a night, like that eats up a pretty big chunk for two weekends of racing.
Did you guys have any obligations at Interbike or didn't even?
No, we went and met with some of our new partners, Lezine, Muckoff. Who else did we see? Mercury, which is a sponsor of the Devo team.
Yeah.
We went and hung out with Feedback for a while at the race. But it wasn't obligations. We just went there because all of these partners were new people that we've been working with this year, and we just wanted to go and meet them. This was our first chance too. But I think it's really important to have that face-to-face relationship you know, at least the marketing people, but better yet, the owners of the company that you're working with.
So this is the first year with Feedback?
Feedback, we're sort of just, we're working at them like at a very grassroots level this year, but they make such great product that we would buy it anyways.
Yeah, they're good to work with as well. Yeah.
And
Kate
seems super
Katie's
sweet.
Nice. Yeah, she's the best.
And I think that Omnium trainer they have is the new standard. Like that's what...
And I think that's a big part of the team from a management side is developing those relationships. So when I started Renewed Cyclocross last year, I mean, my main motto was I want to create a sustainable platform that's going to be there for years to come and eventually develop into something a little bit more. And by doing that, like I feel very passionate about developing those partnerships and making friendships with people and having that two-way direction there. And so what was pretty amazing when we met this year is I think I brought on every single sponsor we had from last year.
Yeah, and we almost did the same on our end too.
Exactly. I think there was, you know, with our bikes, there was a conflict there that we couldn't bring on two different bikes. But,
right.
you know, even with our wheels, so Easton supplies all of our wheels and components for all the professional side and the components for the Devo side. But then Mercury stepped up and they provide all the wheels for our Devo team.
Mm-hmm.
So to have that type of support and be able to split that up, and, you know, both Craig at Easton and Chris and Karen at Mercury are awesome people. And those are the type of things we want to focus on. You
yeah.
know, when we look at 100%, like mm-hmm. those were people we brought over from motocross.
Oh, nice.
Actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was actually it is we were looking at possible opportunities for an eyewear sponsor, and Dylan knows one of the guys 100% from his motocross days. It wasn't through the bike side of things at all, really. It was a motocross connection. So which is really cool.
So did you hang out with Vanderpool and Mason?
We didn't hang out with Vanderpool and Mason so much. We hung out with the 100% guys on the Friday night before that. That was definitely quite the setup. I think it was funny for those guys coming from motocross when everyone has rigs that big.
Right.
They showed up at Crossrace and they're like, we feel a little bit out of place with our massive RV.
That's like if you go to the Mountain Bike World Cups when they're double weekends with the downhills and the cross country. It's like the cross country is still like, you know, you got an RV and a sprinter and like 10 set up. And then the downhills are like, here is our RV that has a cafe in it and
yeah.
and
yeah.
seating for 20. And
so we talk about that all the time. You know, our
semi,
our trailer isn't anything fancy. You know, we've spent some time decking out on the inside and putting all the toolboxes and countertops and bike stuff, and you know, it's amazing the response you get in cycling compared to other disciplines. You know, you show up to another race and you know, motocross, and like, who's that redneck with that
yeah.
trailer?
Yeah, and I thought it was funny because you were saying like motocross doesn't have any more money and people are just willing to put the second mortgage on their house.
Yeah, exactly. You yeah. know, everyone has a $40,000 toy hauler.
Oh,
even for their 5-year-old kid.
Yeah.
It's just yeah. a difference. So yeah. it's funny to see where the
junior
money
parents
goes.
Are the same everywhere.
We didn't have quite that nice, that's for sure. But yeah, you know, and it's funny to see like 100%, you know, the people that they sponsor, you know, they sucked up Matthew and Sana and Peter.
Right.
And so they've got all the big names just like that. You know, yeah. there's not hardly another company I can think out there that have that, but they know that they have to spend money to make money. And I think that comes from other sports, to where cycling, for some reason, for having such a well-to-do demographic, we do not have the same amount of money in it as stick and ball sports or other motor sports.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. But it's also what I like, and just hearing you all talk about this, is that we hear a lot of complaints and a lot of hand-wringing about how there isn't any money out there and there aren't any, and sponsors don't want to, you know, pony up anything. And it sounds like, and I know that you all have worked your butts off to do this, but it sounds like it's possible.
Yeah, so our model actually is we're looking to build a group of sponsors that will continue, like Dylan was saying. Like, yeah, having that one massive title sponsor is great and everything, but I think to really have a sustainable model, our vision is to have lots of smaller sponsors that are excited about the team, maybe because it's giving them exposure, but maybe because they're just excited about the team.
So how do you generate that excitement? I mean, other than just showing up and racing, which we all know.
So we genuinely want to be the most welcoming team out there
mm-hmm.
when it comes to, like, what we want people to feel like they can walk up to our trailer and talk to us at any point in time. And I know, I'm not saying that the other teams aren't like that right now, but I think we really want to go out of our way to make people feel like they have some involvement or ownership with this team, especially for the sponsors, to have them be a part of something, a part of a project,
yeah.
something they're excited about.
So are you sending them like separate updates about what's going on? I mean, how that's more like, I mean, what is the inner, because I feel like that's a thing. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I do, and that's, I think,
yeah,
why,
yes.
know.
So one of the big things with the industry partners is all content. They all want content, and
right.
that's, and we've worked really hard to get photographers at every single race that are providing content, and then generate a little bit of our own content too. As far as the general community,
thank you for that from my from my little community of people.
Yeah, we have two of your photographers who Ethan Glading, and Bruce now is actually helping us out just on this weekend.
Right.
And it's amazing how much people in the industry are appreciative of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because I think it's just, I mean, Craig works in the bike industry. I work in the bike industry. It's difficult to find something good to talk about every single weekend with a good photo that you're allowed to use.
Right. You know, and that's the thing. And that allowed to use, and also, I mean, just to, I mean, get on my own little pedestal of knowing what is quality when you have a photographer, knowing that there is an actual skill to making sure that your sponsors are showing up in those photos that they are taking of you when you are racing and stuff, you know, that's like, that's so key. That
we give Ethan a very vague shot list before a lot of the weekends. Yeah. Like, hey, could you like get something along those lines? But besides that, it's up to you. Like we need something with muck off being applied to a chain. But besides that, like do whatever you want. You're the artist. I'm just some hack on a bike.
He's good at making that happen.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And then as far as the other art, the other, what we want to build in the future, it's still very much in infancy right now, is we want to partner our team with a much larger club structure. So we actually do have a club structure that we're working loosely with this season, but our vision for the future is to add a whole club team that people, anyone can sign up and join where they're racing. I'm not sure exactly what it'll look like yet, but where they're racing in a similar kit. And where they, again, where they have some ownership of the team, they're a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be a big, encompassing family that welcomes everybody in. Just at a few, you know, there's the pro level, there's the Devo level, and then maybe there's a third club level that people can just sign up and join.
And I think that's something unique to us. You know, we want to build, I guess you could say, build it from the top down to where, you know, you have a lot of great teams out there. And, you know, as Jeremy's team, you know, being the only other professional team, but yet they don't have that development team and they don't have the club team with that. And, you know, Transitions Life Care is actually a local club team in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that's very involved with, say, Ruts and Guts and Hurtland and all of those. And they have 40 men and women that that are very focused on cyclocross. And so partnering with them, primarily helping us because they love the sport and want to be a part of it, but we want to be able to give back to them, you know, give product back to them, give discounts back to them, and kind of...
And also the opportunity to do clinics and camps. Like, I think what a lot of cyclists at this high level don't realize is they actually can provide a lot of value to your average Joe through these cycling clinics and through a lot of master cyclists and Cat 4 or 5, whatever, just want to learn how to get better and to see what the professionals do.
Yep.
And one way of doing that is to do what Powers did with Behind the Barriers, and that's really cool. But the other way that fits well within our budget is to do that by welcoming everyone in on a regular basis. You know, we don't have the resources to put together a television series. So
Right.
And I'm not sure we'd want to, even if we did, that's already been done. But we do have the ability to partner with all these other cyclists and let them be a part of what we're doing and bring them in.
Nice. Should we chat about today's race a little bit?
Oh, sure, if we have to. Yeah, this is actually one of the best things about having, like, sometimes people ask, like, oh, well, couldn't you do a privateer model? And the answer is, I guess so. I don't know. I've never really thought of it. Part of the reason that we have a team is, like, we want something that's bigger than any individual rider. But there are definitely other benefits to it, too. Like, I didn't have a great race today, but someone on the team did. You know, there were some development team riders that rode out of their socks and had a great time, really good results for themselves. So it's so cool to have these other, like, yeah,
so
I'm not
stoked. How many people are at Charm City race? Or are you just talking about, like,
no,
overall, like, everywhere? Here.
Yeah, so we have seven of our 13 are here this weekend.
Okay, and what levels, from what to what, is everybody racing?
They're all racing in the elite categories.
Okay.
a lot of our development team is U23 riders. We have a couple senior riders, but we really want to focus on U23 riders. I think there's a lot of support for junior cyclists out there, and I know you think this too. There's a lot of support for junior cyclists there, and we really wanted our team to be needs-based. So if there was a junior cyclist that really needed our help, I wouldn't say that that's not an option. But for most part, juniors are living with their parents. They are tied to a good support structure. There's teams that have money to help them. But it's sometimes it seems like once you get into U23, or even when you're 23 and just out of U23 category, like that really drops off. You're not living with your parents. You're having to buy groceries in addition to race registrations and kit and bikes. And if we can help that group out a little bit, there's so many people stop cycling when they transition from junior to U23 because they realize there are other things in life than cycling too, but also because it gets more difficult to do.
So most of our riders, as he said, are U23, but I would say all of them are at the level of snagging UCI points doing World Cups. I think we had 7 riders that did World Cups this year already across both teams. Of course, those being primarily Canadian. But I mean, we had probably 10 or 11 show up those first 2 weekends, and we're able to, you know, they're always breaking something. They're always forgetting something. We had one rider today, her crank was falling off. And then I go to tighten the crank back on, and the chain ring was loose as well. So just stuff like that, teaching them how to do that,
right.
You know, how do you warm up for a race, is bringing a lot more value to them. But all of them they've already been there. Like I said, most of them have national championships or podiums.
The dream would be to look 5 years down the road and great if our team is going strongly and some of them are riding for us. But the dream would be to see members from the Devo team right now successful in whether cyclocross or road or outside of that too, but just being successful in whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, we hope that this is the next class of cyclists that we're helping along now.
No, that's great. I love that. I love that age group too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I felt like I grew so much between being 18 and 22, 23.
Yeah.
That I would hardly recognize the same person from the start of it to the end. So it's so important to have just a little bit of support and a little bit of a safety net, a little bit of help.
Especially if you are at that elite level, I talked about, you know, my whole thing was the people who just can't afford it and don't have grades. So even if you're like, your people are putting off going to grad school, doing other things in their life that they could be doing to, you know, furthering their careers outside of cycling, and you're sort of making that decision. Sort of, it seems like a gamble for a lot of people.
Yeah, so, I did that same thing. I have a university degree now, but I prolonged getting it. I took some semesters off, and then after that, this is the first year where I've had like a normal job. I took a couple years away from it entirely. So, but now I'm work. Well, I work 30 hours. I don't work a full time job, but I have like a 9-to-5 now.
Right.
For the first time, which I feel like I got to the point where I'm good enough at training and managing myself that I can do that and still race well. But for those first couple of years, thankfully my wife was working and able to support me.
How old are you now?
25.
Okay. How old are you?
Same.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not old yet.
Yeah, I know. You're not.
Although, they called me Grandpa Dylan.
Yeah, Dylan's a 20 or a 45-year-old in a 25-year-old's body.
I like to think I'm the opposite. Like the guy we had tweeting today, Nate, who's awesome. He was talking about something. I found. I was like, "What year were you born?" He was like, 1988. I'm like, "Okay. Do you want to know where I was 1988? He was like, high school. I was like, nope, college. I was like, okay.
One of the coolest things about cycling is that you can have someone who was born in the 1960s and someone who was born in the 90s, and they can have I think it really brings together different age groups. And I've noticed this because for a while I was a club coach with a cycling club. And as I think a lot of people know, cycling clubs are mostly like 40 to 55 or 60 year old men mainly, but you know, yeah, some women as well. And just being able to, like, I couldn't think of another sport or that many other situations where I'd get to ride with people who are that much older than me and like have conversations about cycling, but also just interact with different generations so easily.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, I see it too. I get like, yeah, a wide range of people who are like, who follow the in the Crosshair stuff. So it's always,
yeah,
it's always cool to race together.
Yeah,
so
yeah, when you look at your metrics.
Because it's the little kids that are like, their parents are like showing them, you know, Svendis videos.
Yeah, watching them, yeah,
which is, it's pretty fun.
Where did those live now? I was actually looking for a couple of them the
other
day.
They're on Vimeo.
They're on Vimeo?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you can actually just search for Svendis on Vimeo and they'll all come up.
Oh, awesome. You were asking us about the race, though, and I just like,
I know,
I just politely,
this is my bad. I get off onto these little tangents.
Yeah.
But, well, all right. So is this your first time in Baltimore, or did you race?
It is.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
what do you think of venue, course,
it was race? It was way better than what I thought when I did a slow lap pre-riding yesterday. The faster you went, the better the course was, the more technical it became. With what you have to work with in the park, I mean, it was, I was never that bored, I should say,
right,
riding around.
And like, it's, what, 95% grass?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the only, well, it's actually a very substantial sand pit in terms of how it impacts the race.
Sure, because it's late in the lap.
Yeah, late in the lap, and I think today's race, at least in the men's side, really came down to, or one of the deciding things was in that sand pit. Even though Tobin ended up catching Jeremy in the end and out sprinting him, that was a very important moment in the race.
Yeah, well, and that's always been, I mean, the conventional wisdom that I always tell people about this race that seemed to hold true until this year. This is the first time I've actually ever seen anybody come from behind in a sprint. I mean, it's obviously Tobin's a super strong sprinter, but
yeah,
usually if you make that turn, since it's such a short and like,
yeah,
uphill sprint.
Well, yeah, we were talking about this. We're like, when are people going to stop taking Tobin to the line? Because he's dusting them every single time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Jeremy gave that up. I mean, you could see it in the last turn. He swept wide, and Tobin was already wheel to wheel with him coming out of the turn. And at that point,
and he even was like, you know, he was, you could, what he told me was like, you know, it's always, it helps too if you're sprinting into a headwind, if you're
yeah,
you know, sitting behind.
But I think it's also one of those things is Tobin has been so successful in those first two rounds of KMC and sprinting that I think riders get it in their mind and also in other people's minds that they're unbeatable in a sprint, and that helps. Tobin's going into that thinking like, I'm going to win this sprint, and Jeremy might be going into like, oh, Tobin's a really good sprinter.
Yeah.
And that...
Do you think that road pedigree has a lot? Because you look at like, I mean,
yeah, but
Howard's
Jeremy
definitely
has
raced
a better road pedigree. He raced professional. Tobin was always,
sure,
a good crit racer.
Well, but that's the difference.
Yeah.
I mean, don't you think? I mean, Jeremy was doing like stage races and stuff. I mean, he'd do his crits, but he was more of a road, not necessarily a crit racer.
I mean, I've raced a few crits with Tobin, and yeah, he's, yeah, very good at it. He's good at using. I mean, he's not a bigger guy at all, but he's bigger than me. He's bigger than Jeremy. He's,
yeah,
bigger than Hyde.
He
right?
rides bigger on the bike. I mean, you can see he's not scared to throw an elbow and get in,
yeah,
there. And you,
yeah,
know, when we talked earlier about flipping that switch off, like Tobin has that when it comes down to the end of the race. And I think you start seeing that a lot last year at Ruts and Guts when
he won four races, you know, in a row last
him
year.
Him and Mike were going head to head in those sprints, and yet Tobin was just coming out on top there against,
yeah,
everyone for those, like you said, those four races. Because
that's true. You
he
did,
was,
yeah,
throwing,
you were,
yeah, I thought I was
going to
win
lot.
Ruts,
yeah,
and Guts, and then, and I think people are going to hear this and think that I don't like. I really like Tobin. I think he's a great racer, and I'm not mad at him for this at all. But like, he came in on the inside and just moved me out of the way and won the sprint.
Yeah,
and like, good on him. But
yeah,
obviously, I would have liked to win. But good on him because that was impressive. And the same thing, I think, the weekend. Two weekends before in CXLA, he won both of those races because one of the things that makes him a really good racer is he's able to make those late moves.
Well, he's also smart. Like, even you talk about, like, he's not afraid to, like, you know, get in there and kind of make his own space. He was talking about today that it was, you know, he was able to sit back a little. I even got gassed on one of those laps, drop back to fourth, but he was also able to just sit there and watch like Hyde and Powers, you know, elbow each other in every turn.
Yeah.
jockeying for position, and he was just like hanging back.
I wonder how much longer, because it's bizarre, but he's won three races in a row, and he's still the forgotten American cyclocross racer.
We talked about that today, which I love his attitude in it, because I'm like, so you're kind of still coming from this underdog, you know, position. He's like, I don't understand why. I see myself as a favorite. You know, I've proven myself. And then, you know, and then just went into the obvious answer is like,
it was amazing.
This East Coast bias that he's still this guy from the West Coast. Obviously, you look at his wins, you look at what he's done in his career.
It blew my mind when I went and listened to the World Cup commentary after that. He's like sitting fifth wheel in Waterloo and no one's saying anything about it.
No, it's no all. One. Yeah, it's Hyde. Powers, and then on the other side, Mani.
Yeah.
She's sort of in that same position. Like, she's never really in it, yet the announcers are just...
Yeah, and here I'm sitting there like this. Wait, when was the last time an American was sitting top five in a World Cup? Like, mind you, he ended up blowing up and finishing, what, 20-something? Yeah. But, like, when was the last time an American was sitting in fifth place, a man.
Yeah, I mean, Hyde kind of did it last year. He was like sixth there for a while before dropping back to, I think, 11th, 10th or 11th. But yeah, but no, it's interesting. But I think it's great. I think it's great that there are different players in there, and that this, as we said, it could not set up any better for the U.S. Cup that they're now. You don't know who's going to win it, so it's
absolutely.
It should be Tobin. He's definitely got a
but
a
everyone
nice lead now, but it's pretty wide open.
And I think tomorrow will be interesting, right? You know, looking at the forecast with 90% chance of rain for Sunday.
Yeah, you know that Hyde has to be sitting looking at that forecast and like laughing with joy or something, because he's good at that.
Yeah,
and Tobin is too, but Hyde is very good at that.
Yeah, and when you talk about kind of validating your stance, we discussed a little bit earlier, like that's a big day, I think, for Tobin, you know, for Mike, you know, to prove that, you know, they can win races that aren't sprints or aren't super fast like Vegas, you know, where he's running up there with Hyde and Swake and all of them, like, so to come into a muddy race like that and validate those results still, I think would be huge for Tobin, for Mike, for you know, we all know Kerry can ride a bike and Hyde can ride a bike. So
do you feel like you're a little bit in that same position,
in the forgotten?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not gonna put my, I think there was a long time when Tobin and I were battling, but this season he's a step ahead of me, and I'll be the first to admit that he's riding really, really well. But as a Canadian, I very much feel like I'm often forgotten, because I see myself as one of the top five riders in North America. You know, mind you, today was a bad race for me, and I finished 12th. But in the World Cups, I was consistently finishing, say, the fourth or fifth best American rider. North American rider.
Yeah.
And I think that was the same story last year, but I don't know if I can blame American media for it, but American media is American rider centrist, and there's focused, and there's definitely those regional, I don't think I want to call them biases, just support clubs. People like riders from their area.
And that's where media is as well, because there isn't a cyclocross being part of it, I don't mind saying it's not a strong media presence.
No.
I mean, it's still. My whole thing's a business. Cyclocross magazine's a business. It's not like we're just like,
if your readership's from New England,
doing it for fun, but at the same time, it's not Velo News. Yet they don't cover it anymore.
Well, Velo News, actually, if the U.S. Cup has done one thing well, it's that Velo News is back on board.
They did start.
They covered Sacramento, and, like, it's almost by extension, because the U.S. Cup was there, they're like, oh, because they did write something about Sacramento, didn't they? Or was it just...
I don't know. They definitely were at KMC.
Yeah, but it's...
And that was a surprise. It was great to see.
Yeah, which is good, because it was very... It was too bad for a long time when the biggest... Well, I guess bicycling's the biggest, but... The most serious racing publication.
Yeah. I mean, bicycling's not a racing publication.
No,
They tried that for a little while with Peter Flax, and that just didn't seem to...
I don't think I need to read any articles about how to lose 10 pounds cycling in 4 weeks and what intervals I should be doing to prepare for my next Grand Fondo.
Yeah.
Because I think those articles are in every single bicycling. Every single one. But yeah, it's cool to see Velo News back in it, because as great as it is to have... you and Cyclocross Magazine doing Cyclocross specific, like, their readership is just
And so also, I mean, I'll be the first to say that I'm not going to give you as far as like your Monday morning roundup of results and everything else, it's not. We wouldn't be talking right now if that's what is the kind of stuff that.
No, this wouldn't
me.
Fly on Villain is.
Yeah, so this is more, you know, what I think I love about the sport is the people in it and the stories, but also, you know, the strategy and the technique and all that kind of stuff, and then results are after that. I feel like there are other places out there to get those kind of.
Yeah. And that's one of the great things about cyclocross. I mean, we were talking about, you know, 30, 40, 50-year-olds all being able to do the same thing. Like in cross, you know, everyone's working on that same technique. Yeah. Like people are, whether they're a beginner or a pro, like they enjoy that type of talk and getting to know people. And I think that obviously J-Pow was successful at that and building that brand.
Yeah.
Like you're able to become more personal. You know, when you look at world tour teams on the road, we don't have that from the American side where people are hands-on.
Right.
And
the people who are participating can relate to them. And my favorite moment of today, especially earlier, was sitting at the scores table, you know, because they had power and editing a video. And it was the 10 o'clock race, and there were two guys, you know, it's not a new story, but they were fighting their hearts out for 39th place and sprinted it. You know, it was basically a photo finish for that 39th place. And there aren't a lot of sports that you get that, you know, that doesn't happen in road racing. And, you know, that's what keeps it vital.
And yeah, I mean,
and that's why they stick around and watch you all race.
Yeah,
because
I love
they want to.
Yeah, I always joke that cyclocross is like the sport where you can tell someone like, yeah, we're friends except for 2 hours every weekend, or like one hour every weekend.
Right.
We're best friends. We're great friends, but like I hate you for
and
1 hour every weekend.
But isn't that crazy thing?
Again.
And it happens on y'all's level too. Is that again not like a road race? Like road race, you're not always ending up with the same guy.
No.
You know, you're not always like crossing the line with this because it's so much more dynamic. Whereas cyclocross is kind of like. That's where you are, and that's where that guy is, and you're always going to be in that group, you know, for the most part with those same people.
Yeah, and I think it's easier to replicate what the pros are doing too, so people get more gratification out of it. You know, you climb Alpe d'Huez, and it's like, okay, he for me climbed it twice as fast, but it's like, okay, you're not really doing that. Like you work on a downhill muddy descent here into a tight 180.
Yeah.
Like you may have a Cat 4 that's able to rail it just as fast and get satisfaction out of that and look at that to compare other than just how fast you can pedal up a hill.
Well, and there's also a level like I can watch Froome climb up to Huez and it doesn't matter what technique he's using. I'm just not going up it that fast.
I will say, however, that covering being out there for the early races and watching the laps, and then when you by the time you all that was a fast race today.
Oh yeah,
because I was like, all right, let me cover this section, and I turn around and I'm like, crap, there they are again.
Yeah, it's actually like Dylan was saying, it's a surprisingly difficult course because you go and look at it and you go, oh, this thing's grass, and then you go and ride it a bit, and there's a lot of tricky off camber turns. There's actually quite a bit of hard pedaling as well.
I don't know if you heard it behind you, that first little hitch, like you go up the mansion from the start.
Yeah.
And then there's that little thing. I don't know where you
I
get stuck
in
that.
It.
Yeah. Like some guy like slid into the stake and cracked it, and you had just gone through. You were like through and then right behind, and then it was just this mayhem.
Yeah, it was that whole right side was mayhem. I think I was the second last call up on the front row, and like so sort of ended up on the right side. But it was pretty scary because we ended up like getting pushed off into the curb a little bit and right against the stakes when we were going up. It almost would have been better off to just start in the first position
on
the left side.
From like a media part, I didn't even watch the start
because
the start's a start, and like unless there's a huge pile up, which I don't want to see, then it doesn't matter. So I like ran, I like took little close-ups and then ran to that first little section on the mansion. I was like, this is where that's where the chaos is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it did. I mean, I started third row, and it looked like I lost about 30 seconds the first lap to the leaders. And that was all having to put a foot down and scooter through because everyone had piled up into the mansion there.
Yeah.
And then it just spreads out after that. You know, the big, long downhill,
and then
everyone's just gone.
And even the guys behind you, because you had to stop, and then once that stake was gone, it was just like
free for all because there was no course left anymore. Everybody just started pouring down the hill back onto the course.
Yeah, it's funny.
What do we got? Hour two plus that other little section.
Is that where we're at already?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't even remember what we talked about.
I don't either. So what else do we need to talk about? I think we should just maybe think about it, and then we can do this again some other time. Because I enjoyed this. This was a good discussion, and I need to go edit some video.
Yeah, you probably have. You're not going to be home sleeping until into the wee hours
in
the morning.
That's all these weekends.
There's no Saturday recovery day for you this weekend.
I don't have to like race tomorrow.
When you started out, were you doing media and racing at the same time?
Yeah, but I mean, I was more concerned with racing. Right. I was never good.
The thing about cyclocross, like you were saying, is like everyone's race matters the same amount to them.
I started doing like just like it was when everybody was doing like helmet cams.
Yeah.
That? So it was 2008, 2009. And I started doing that. And then I started doing course previews, where I would do like a voiceover over the helmet cam. And that's kind of how like Svendis almost started back then. Because I was sort of like doing these little analysis of courses where everybody else was just putting their helmet cams out there. I was like, let me talk over to sort of explain different sections. And then I'd have like a forward and a backward camera and all this kind of stuff.
And then Sven obviously was the most dominant rider.
Yeah,
at the time.
And then it just kind of...
And the best technically.
Well, and then I started, you know, my other job is kind of it had a little bit of reporting in it, a little other stuff, but it's all legal government contracting stuff. Wasn't that interesting. So I was like, let me just do some of that, bring some of those skills over. So I started interviewing people and just started putting all that up. So it became like just sort of a written interview site, and then it moved to video, and then,
Yeah, I don't know if you probably didn't see it, but we stole a concept of, I think it was a moment in Sven Nessen or one of like, we just started having a YouTube channel to do a couple things. And we started timing some lines because it was interesting.
Yeah.
And that was like very much what you were doing. And I think it was the moment of Sven
Nessen videos, right? Put down a finish line on little sections and
that stuff's actually crazy, because what feels like the fastest line in a race isn't always the fastest line. And what looks like the fastest line isn't always the fastest line.
Well, and you know, one of the things that I think is why it's important for amateur racers to hang around and watch you all, is you can see all of the burned in lines from the day. And then when you guys get onto the track, you're nowhere near them.
Mm-mm. Yeah. For a few reasons. One,
well, I know it's part of this because of traction, but it's also because I think of the speed. And I think just how you're hitting those lines and those corners, that you're taking completely different lines.
And so one thing I've noticed, like some, I wouldn't classify them as good promoters, but some promoters that are more aware and maybe actually have the spare time somehow on the weekend, is you'll notice they widen out the stakes in certain areas by a foot or a half a foot before the UCI races. And it's amazing the difference sometimes between pre-ride when you're like, man, that's tight, that's not working well. Because I noticed a couple places today to where they widen out, and it's like, oh, that's flowing so much better. I'm not having to get on the binders the whole time.
Yeah.
It's very different. I've noticed with course design a lot, because I mean, I really love like racing local races, but you get a real mixed bag of course designs when you do that.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a huge difference when someone who races Cat 4 designs a course or someone who races Elite, because you build the course for the speed that you go.
Right.
And there's a big difference between a Cat 4 speed, and not because they're worse at handling their bike, but because they just don't pedal as hard as the elites, right? Yeah.
Well, and that's all. I think with this Charm City course, what I've noticed about it, although it seems like they're more turn, the up and down little U-turns.
Those were good corners.
The SRAM corners.
Yeah.
That's
the only tight section. I was just about to say that. Every other section on the course flows.
Right.
That one is actually tight and kind of bottles up. But tomorrow, you know, is boring today when it's dry. But tomorrow, that's going to be one of the most technical sections, because every one of those turns are now completely dirt and they're off camber a little bit.
Right.
So what we were railing through today.
Yeah, you might
no
have to
problem.
Run it, or you have to take a totally different line to ride it.
Yeah.
And even today, as the race went on, that last corner when you were exiting started getting a little bit of a dust rut. where it was just a little bit slippery, and
they look really pretty when you take pictures of them.
Yeah,
that's right.
With all the branding.
Well, not even that. It's just because the light comes through there, and there's just so much dust that it just like starts streaming through.
Dusty,
it
dusty cyclocross photos are almost as cool as muddy cyclocross photos, is what I was looking at a bunch from. I think it was in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it was Wisconsin was awesome for it, and then I mean KMC at night with those lights coming through that.
Oh yeah,
like,
I saw those.
Ooh, yeah, those were good.
I saw those photos too.
Yeah,
there's some good ones.
All right, I think we did it.
All right,
thank you all.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. Thanks for coming over and waiting for us to be 30 minutes late.
You brought me pizza. It was all worth it.
That is our. See, I'm not a member of the Wide Angle Podium, so I've been feeling guilty about it.
There, you have contributed.
So now, this is my membership for at least a month or two, is
absolutely.
Pizza for Bill.
Yeah.
So now I can stop, like, looking down at the ground when every time I see Spencer. I'm like, sorry, Spencer, Bill.
Yeah, no, I don't stand out those. Where should people follow along for team stuff or even personal stuff?
Yeah, so you can follow along the team at Garno Easton on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook is Garno Easton, presented by Transitions Life Care. We also have a YouTube channel, which is Garno Easton, which only has a couple videos now, but I'm going to go work on putting up a race recap one as soon as we're done here. And then we have a website with information about the riders, which is www.ethicalracingproject. That's the name from the original team.com.
Yeah. And just from a management standpoint, like, I just want to say, like, we want people to come up to us. Like, we want people to follow us, and they do. And, like, we don't mind those questions, and we want to be open. And, you know, if you have questions on Facebook, we're going to start a little Wednesday series to where we allow fans to ask different questions, whether that's budget or how to ride a section, whatever it is. Like, we want to get involvement and be open to other people to develop the sport, like I said, and create a sustainable model that's going to continue to grow American cyclocross, because we have a passion for that, whether that's in the U.S. or in Canada. And so hopefully we can give people an inside look at kind of what we're doing with those race recaps when we're fresh, and not be all dolled up and, you know, getting the podium interview. So
mine today, I was sitting there like, you ready to do your race recap? Yeah, whatever. Like, I need to sit down to do it, I think, but we'll get this done. Here's a dehydrated, heat exhausted Mike telling you about his race.
Oh, those are the best. That's how I interviewed Tobin today. I just sat there in front of him for a couple of minutes, and I was like, so let's talk. And he just went into it.
He looked wrecked when I saw him when you were interviewing him. And you want the winner of the race to look like he's ready to keel over.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
It was really cool when Steven was winning all these races last year, when Jeremy before. And when Matthew's winning now, that's great, but like, They're winning, and they look like they're ready to do another lap. Whereas this race, it finished, and I don't think Jeremy or Tobin or Steven, like, they want to lie on the ground for a while.
Oh, they were all wrecked, yeah. And I just remember, you know, everybody was talking about how, like, horribly hot Waterloo was.
This felt hotter, even though it was less hot.
Well, not even that. Like, Vanderpool, like, rolled across the line and then just rolled back, you know, just didn't even stop, rolled back to the tent, and was just sitting back there. I mean, he may have even been, like, on the phone to Dad. You know, it was just
How'd you do, son? Oh, I won again, Dad.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas the people who were racing further back in the field, like, I went across the line in Waterloo and had to sit on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, everybody did, except for him.
Like,
out of here.
It's like, I only went 90% today.
Right. Exactly. It's a training ride. Awesome. All right, guys.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
All right. There you have it. Another Crosshairs Radio episode in the books. Thanks to Mike and also to Dylan for the chat. If you need to get in touch with me, feedback@cxhairs.com. You can also follow along on Twitter and Instagram @cxhairs. Call the hotline if you want to go that route. It is 405-CX-HAIRS. Leave a message and we may play it on the air in our next TDD TIE episode. All right, have a great one, and we'll talk to you soon.